It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Even before her involvement with the Black Panther Party in the 1970s, Angela Davis has been advocating for change. She grew up in segregated Birmingham, Alabama, where family friends were the victims of the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. Her experience of being on the FBI's top 10 most wanted list galvanized her as an activist. Today, she is a distinguished professor emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and author of many books. She'll be in Des Moines on Thursday, September 29th, giving a lecture sponsored by the Chrysalis Foundation called How Change Happens. I spoke with her on Friday afternoon. We're speaking at a time when many people in the United States feel like we've reached a crisis point in racial relations. From your perspective, with so many years of experience advocating for social justice, does this feel like a crisis point to you?
Well, actually, conditions have not significantly changed. What is different about this moment, I think, is the fact that movements are developing and are demanding that a public attention be focused, for example, on the seemingly permanent character of racist violence, particularly racist state violence, violence at the hands of the police, violence in relation to over-incarceration, et cetera. So I think what marks this particular historical conjuncture is the fact that young people especially are rising up, Black Lives Matter, the Dream Defenders, many other organizations of youth around the country.
I think about the fact that it was just 2 years ago when Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson. And there, of course, was a national conversation. There was a great deal of coverage and a national conversation about what we need to do to move forward from this point. Now, 2 years later, we're reacting to the deaths of Keith Scott in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And it doesn't feel at this moment like much has changed. Do you think that anything has changed since Ferguson?
What has changed since Ferguson is that greater public consciousness and therefore media coverage of police killings in Black communities. That is, I think, what has changed. The dilemma seems to be that people are not willing to seriously consider what it might mean to make real structural change in the character of policing, in the nature of punishment in this society. And as long as we aren't willing to engage in those conversations, we are bound to see a repetition of the same. In a sense, we've witnessed this repetition of police violence, of state violence, since the end of slavery. I always point out that I can actually chart my entire trajectory as a political activist by pointing to particular cases of people who have been killed by the police or by vigilante violence. I can, you know, go all the way back to Emmett Till and to the four young Black girls at the 16th Street Baptist Church. This kind of violence has been with us for a long time. And to purge our society of this violence will require some very deep conversations and a deep consciousness of the extent to which the very nature of our society in the United States of America is determined by the racism.
I want to ask you, in 2008, people were asking the question. It was common in the media for panels to have conversations about the question, have we arrived at a post-racial America now that we have a Black president in the United States? In retrospect, that seems like an incredibly naive question. I'm sure a lot of people felt it was a naive question at the time. What was your reaction when you heard people talking about that in 2008?
The question itself was so premature and so naive. The very concept of post-raciality seems to point to an effort to deny the influence of racism in our society. And certainly the election of one person to the presidency was not going to transform, you know, the so deeply entrenched in the structures of our society. So, you know, this is what many of us were talking about at the time when this question of the post-racial began to be raised. It's not simply the replacement of individuals of African descent or other individuals of color in positions of power. It is about examining the extent to which the structures and institutions of our society have been so thoroughly influenced by forms of racism, both historical and contemporary. Now, there's also the question of confusing race with racism. While we know that race itself is socially constructed, it has played a powerful role in our society.
Of course, no one is talking about a post-racial America right now. In this presidential election year, race has become a topic of conversation a lot. And divisions that have been present, clearly, in the United States for a very long time have been exposed in a new way. Do you find anything positive about that?
Oh, absolutely. I think what is most exciting about the present moment is the fact that we are being compelled to engage in conversations that should have happened decades ago, at the end of the period during which slavery was abolished. These are conversations, these are you know, ways of thinking about the nature of our society that we should have acknowledged many, many, many years ago. So it's good that activists who are involved and on the ground, you know, protests and demonstrations have forced these conversations. And I don't think it's accidental that they are happening during the last portion of the second administration of the first black president. The very evocation of the post-racial and the contradiction between the notion of the post-racial and the continued existence of racism at so many levels of the society, that is the contradiction that has, in a sense, come to a head during this period.
Something that we have been hearing recently with these recent incidents with police violence, we're talking on the afternoon of Friday, September 23rd, and the video of the shooting of Keith Scott in Charlotte, North Carolina was released today. And so all afternoon, I've been hearing the voice of his wife, Rakia Scott, trying to protect her husband. She's trying to de-escalate the situation before her husband is shot. And her voice echoes what we heard in the voice of Diamond Reynolds when she was in the car with Philando Castile in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Her calm reaction trying to deal with this situation. What do you hear in these women's voices? What message do you think they can carry to the rest of the United States?
We've all been, you know, very moved hearing those voices of women who are in the midst of this critical situation, which unfortunately too many times has led to the killing of their male partners. I think that, well, first of all, women have played a major role in this new movement. If you look at the leadership of networks like Black Lives Matter, you see women in the leadership, and they're pointing out that while, you know, certainly black men tend to be the targets of police violence, this should not allow us to forget about the fact that many women have also been killed. And also, over the last several years, we've been able to look at situations where a good number of women who have had mental health problems have been killed by the police precisely because of their disabilities. And in a sense, we can say that to be a black woman and to have a psychiatric disability can lead to fatal consequences when one comes into contact with law enforcement. So, you know, this issue of state violence is vast. You know, another connection that women and feminists, and I'm not suggesting that feminists are necessarily women, feminists of all genders. Another connection that we've begun to recognize is the relationship between the violence at the hands of the police, violence in relationship to the punishment system, and violence within the community, what is often referred to as black-on-black violence. On the one hand, and also intimate violence. So, you know, feminist perspectives allow us to trace the relations between state violence, institutional violence on the one hand, and individual violence or intimate violence on the other. And these analyses, I think, are beginning to be taken up by organizers who recognize that we cannot simply look at one manifestation of violence and expect to figure out ways to purge our societies of that violence without recognizing the whole canvas.
When I first learned that I would get an opportunity to talk with you, I thought that I would love to spend a half an hour talking with you about your life, about the work you've done and what you've learned over the years. And then I found that as the time grew nearer with all of the events going on, that seemed like the wrong use of our time. But when you think about the fact that you've been involved in a number of movements, but in many ways the same movement for the last nearly 50 years, and you're still sharing the same messages, still fighting for the same thing, how does that make you feel?
Well, you know, in a sense, you have been talking to me about what I've learned over the years. You have been talking to me about my life. And I can't say that I have approached the same problems in the same way, because I've learned a great deal from my involvement in struggles and movements. And I think that to simply suggest that this is an inevitable permanent repetition of the same would ignore how important movements themselves have been. And thus, in this last period, I think we've begun to recognize how important it is to look at the individual case against the backdrop of the structural violence. I can remember 10 years ago, many of us were saying, well, you know, why is it that there is this refusal to recognize that racism is not simply an individual matter? You know, why is the focus always on people who engage in racist acts, whether it's like verbal racism or whether it's racism with respect to assault on individuals? Why cannot we make the connection between those expressions of racism and the institutional and structural character of racism. So I think that now the popular discussion points to these structures and these institutions. And that, to me, represents a major victory. I'm very happy to see that. And I've learned a great deal myself from the young people who have been organizing over the last several years, over the last decade, I would say, as a person who has embraced the position of abolition, or you might say abolition feminism. I've learned a great deal from young people who inevitably are able to use the work that previous generations have been engaged in, myself included, and to move forward. They stand on our shoulders, so to speak.
What do you draw on when you need hope, when you need strength to keep going?
Well, ever since I was a young child, I've learned how to draw strength from the communities of which I feel a member. From the time I was growing up in what was the most segregated city in the country, Birmingham, Alabama, when segregation, Jim Crow, ruled over every aspect of our lives, to the period when I was myself the target of repression and placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, charged with 3 capital crimes, placed in jail, and forced to go on trial. My strength has always come from the people with whom I struggle to create communities of resistance and communities of struggle.
Angela Davis, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Certainly, thank you.
Angela Davis, scholar, activist, she will be speaking in Des Moines on Thursday, September 29th, giving a lecture sponsored by the Chrysalis Foundation called How Change Happens. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.